Hello, my name is Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 21 for July the 7th, 2014. Went through my notes, how to start, what to talk about. It's a big sporting time this time of the year. Tour de France is on, just started. And it's starting in England. Speaking of England, the home of soccer. At least that's where the modern game originated and is played the most and probably talked about the most, or at least it used to be that way. As I talked about last week, England's been sort of bypassed with soccer, and I think it just finally hit me for the first time. I just sort of assumed that it was bad coaching. That's what I'd assumed for a long time. And I don't think the coaches are good, because I mean a coach can change a team just like that if they want to. Jurgen Klinsmann for the Americans, you know, he changed that team. He made a good team. And they came close. They came very close to advancing and not to winning at all. But they did respectable. The goalie was truly exceptional. And you know, it's interesting. Soccer does come down to individuals. Almost without exception. Even right now, to me, the greatest group of individuals is Brazil. But still, individual players really stand out on that team. It's just every player stands out on that team. I guess Brazil is a combination of a great team and great individuals, and they will probably win just because of that. But my favorite team is Argentina because of Messi, Lionel Messi, and he played yesterday. Oh boy, did he play yesterday. Wow. It was the morning game. There's two games yesterday. The afternoon game was Netherlands versus Costa Rica. Costa Rica, sort of the underdog team of the tournament this year. Going farther than anyone thought they would. They did lose to the Netherlands in penalty kicks, PKs, which is not a nice way for a game to end. In hockey, you don't get that. Hockey, they play overtimes until one team scores in what they call sudden death. And in soccer, they've gone away from that. They used to call it, when they had it, they called it the golden goal, the goal that would ultimately win the game. And for some reason, soccer went away from that. And yet, really, that's how the game should end. The next goal wins it. It's like that in so many sports. In football, they have sudden death overtime now. There's some rules, and actually in football they make it fair. Each side is supposed to get a chance to get the ball. Because unlike soccer and football, you don't turn over the ball as readily. In soccer, you can turn it over every 5 seconds. It's not a big deal. But football, once you've got possession, your chances of scoring are a lot better than the other team's. So soccer, you know, it's just made a lot of bad choices. And one of the things that stood out in my mind this last week in watching the games, and it's been a real treat of soccer, there's been a lot of soccer. One of the real severe weaknesses is, and I don't know if I talked about this particular thing, but it's like another weakness of soccer. They have something called the advantage rule. And the advantage rule says if I have the ball and you commit a foul against me, well, as long as I still have the ball, the referee doesn't blow his whistle. And the idea is you're playing the advantage. I have an advantage, or you haven't taken away my advantage, supposedly. It doesn't really make sense, does it? If you fouled me, then you have, right? I mean, how much do you have to take away my advantage for that cheating, that rule-breaking, that infraction to benefit you? If it takes away any of my advantage, if you knock me off my stride illegally, yeah, I still have the ball, but I wobbled. I slowed down. The other team caught up. You know, soccer and its fouls is a lot like basketball in that the offending team benefits from fouls. Well, the worst thing is this. At least in basketball, they blow the whistle. Yeah, it stops play and makes it boring, and yeah, they don't give enough of a penalty benefit to the team that got fouled, but at least they stop play. In soccer, they don't. And so what can happen is you can get fouled repeatedly with no consequence at all to the other team. No consequence at all. Nothing lost. You're going along with the ball. Let's say you're really good at holding on to the ball. And I can jostle you. I can kick you. I can try and trip you. I can literally commit 3 or 4 fouls in a row. The referee will have his hand up, but he'll point forward saying, Floyd has the advantage. Keep going. So of course they're going to do that. In soccer we used to call it chippy, a chippy game. Soccer is a very chippy game. Well, 2 days ago Brazil played their quarterfinal match and their great player Neymar got injured, out for the entire tournament on basically a chippy play. that's it. Nothing really more than that. A player jumped into the fray and jumped into Neymar's back and cracked a vertebrae in his back. I don't even know if there was a big penalty in that play or any penalty. It was just one of those Brazil gets the ball and they kick it and keep going kind of plays. So, what soccer needs is a graduated penalty system, not just the yellow card or essentially no penalty. Hang on, I got the cat wanting to go out here. Alright, cat in, cat out. Dog's comfy. Tour de France on and on mute. So, you need a graduated system of penalties that take away advantage to the fouler. Right now, ironically, the advantage rule, which was meant to help the attacking team and keep the game exciting, makes the game less fair and rewards the savages. It rewards the savage play. And there's been plenty of that. Tackles where they come racing in with their cleats up and they ostensibly are going for the ball, and sometimes they get away with it and there's no penalty. Sometimes the other team is awarded a free kick because you came in, you know, high, you came in rough. And then sometimes, because your cleats were just a little bit higher than normal, they'll give a yellow card. It's very indiscriminate. Where the simple thing you could have is, you could call it sliding tackle. And you give the team that does it, you give them a 1 minute or 2 minute penalty in the penalty box. That's it. The player just goes off. Well, then they definitely lose. Hockey does this better than anything else. When you commit a foul, you have a player off the ice, and that is a huge, huge factor. And it's very leveling. Hockey just might be one of the most level, even sports. Fair sports in terms of the better team wins. I'm trying to think, it's not very often where I think the better team did not win the whole thing, the Stanley Cup, at the end of a hockey season. Whereas even football, you could say, one or two calls. I remember there was a famous game of Seattle-Green Bay. And in the end zone, the Seattle player supposedly caught the ball, but the Green Bay player ripped it away from him or something, but they ruled that the Seattle player caught it. It was a touchdown. Seattle won the game, and it was a big game. It might even have been a playoff game. It comes back to that fairness, right? And did the right team win? In that case, the right team did not win. So yesterday, when Messi was playing, there was one point, and it became comical. The color commentary guy, who was excellent, it was Casey Killam or something like that, another American color commentator guy, and he was excellent. So Taylor Twellman and this Casey Killam, or Kalem, both excellent American color commentators for soccer. You know, America, to me, in soccer, they have the we must improve, we must do better mentality. England, they're over the hill. It's all about the money. The guys are paid fantastically large contracts, and they're not really keeping track. Let's be honest. The South American teams, they grow up with soccer. They don't need a special training program to catch up to the rest of the world. They're leading the world. All the South American teams. Chile was phenomenal. Colombia, even though they lost this last weekend, they were phenomenal. Argentina, Brazil, that's four South American teams. Uruguay was significant. You know, they're all doing just fine. The Americans are the only team that's really moving in the ranks, really trying to get better. And, you know, hats off to them for that. But yesterday, anyway, the American color guy just sort of had to chuckle and said, they just keep fouling Messi. And in one sequence that lasted probably 1 or 2 seconds, they fouled Messi 4 times. Messi had the ball. He was surrounded by 3 or 4 players, which he was all day. And they fouled him 4 times in a row. And finally, they tripped him and he fell to the ground. And they got their little free kick and nothing happened, right? So they got away with 3 of the 4 fouls were nothing. There was 0 consequence. And then on the 4th one, it was a trivial consequence and nothing happened. That's soccer. That's soccer penalties. It's horrible. There's no excuse for it. It's like the soccer system is so myopic. It's so unable to look around it at other sports and see what other sports have done. Here's an example of a sport that is looking around. Baseball. Baseball, 10 years ago, did not have any kind of replays. And I don't know when it exactly started, but let's say 5 years ago, they started showing replays. That is to say, accurate replays of the pitches around the plate. What they started to do was, occasionally, on occasional pitches, they introduced it really kind of subtly and smoothly. The idea is that baseball is very traditional, and if you start making accurate calls, well, you're changing the game. You know, the game is an umpire, and the umpire is variable. Sometimes he thinks it's a strike when it's a ball, and vice versa. And the teams literally get to know the strike zone according to that ump that day. the first couple of batters, they come back to the rest of the team and they tell them, well, he's calling a loose game or he's calling a tight game. Well, anyway, they started showing the pitches or showing the replays where the ball actually was exactly when it crossed over the plate. So showing the ball in three dimensions, basically, for select pitches. And then you started to realize, wow, these umpires, sometimes they're 6 inches off. Well, it's now progressed that they show all the pitches. And they have that little box that shows the strike zone. They have it up all the time. They've added replay of certain key plays in the game. You know, did it go over the foul pole or to the left or to the right? I think last week I was talking about Bo Jackson. When Bo Jackson first went up to bat in his first baseball game, Major League Baseball game, this is a complete rookie. Bo Jackson, the brilliant, natural talent, mega athlete, he goes up there and on his first swing, he hits the ball over the foul pole. And they called it a ball, a foul ball. When, if they could have had a replay, if replay was in place, that's all, they could know exactly, was it fair or foul? Another sport that's brought in some really good replay is tennis, called Shot Spot. It was something pioneered, really pushed by McEnroe, John McEnroe, the intolerable John McEnroe as a player. He knew what tennis needed, and he got it. Shot Spot is all John McEnroe, and it's all good. It shows you where the ball is exactly, to the maybe tenth of an inch, and so they get certain number of replays per set. They think the ball is, say the ball was called out, and they think it was in, they ask for a replay. The Shot Spot replays the simulated flight of the ball exactly and shows exactly where it landed, down to that fraction of an inch, and that's the ruling. Totally fair. And frequently they get it wrong, the umpires and officials. And who can blame them? Come on. Tennis, it's really, I mean, I've played a lot of tennis, and it's really easy to misjudge whether a ball was in or not. I mean, if two people are playing in tennis, there will be a disagreement of up to, like, let's say 6 inches. In other words, it could be 6 inches out and still one of the two people thought it was in and vice versa. So tennis has got it nailed. All they had to do was bring a Shot Spot, problem solved. Baseball introduced it gradually, very smart. Baseball is getting more and more into the replay world, and it's helping the game. It's making the game more fair. Soccer, they got goal line technology. Let's give them credit. This year at the World Cup, they have goal line technology. And they show that ball absolutely exactly when it comes to the goal line. By the way, so does hockey. They've had this for, who knows, 10 years or more, where they have cameras in the goal and they can show that ball exactly. And they always review goals that were close. They've had that nailed for a while, but soccer's got that. Good for them. The offside thing in soccer. Every time I watch soccer, I go, why do they have offsides? Why do they have them? What is the big deal? You know, it's interesting in hockey, they had two levels of offsides. The puck must go over the blue line before the players rule. And then they had the you can't pass the puck more than two lines rule. In hockey, there's N lines, like in soccer, and then there are blue lines and the red line, which is the center line. So if you pass the puck over a blue line and a red line together in one pass, that would be considered an offside pass. Well, interesting thing, roughly 5 or 10 years ago, hockey got rid of that. That's no longer a penalty, and it shouldn't have been. What were they doing with that? What are they worried about with offsides? If you don't have offsides, in theory, this is all I can think of, one player could camp out at the other goal. He could just wait there because he's never offside, and you can just pass it to him any time. And, you know, okay, you don't want that, right? Because it's sort of like, you know, symbolically in basketball, you know, you'll see in movies like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he gets the chief to stand underneath the hoop, and the chief is so tall he can just reach up and dunk the basket. You don't want someone camping out at the goal in any sport. And so it's same in soccer, I suppose. But the way the offsides are enforced, it's to the millimeter, and it's all the way up to center field. Now, in hockey, they have a blue line. So what that says is you can't be offside at center in hockey, but you can be offside at the blue line and only at the blue line. Well, at soccer, you can be offside at any time from center field all the way to the goal, and that's at any time. You kick a corner kick where the ball is automatically as far down the field as you can get, and right after that kick, if a guy heads it to another guy and that second guy's offside, bang. Play over. Why? It's archaic. There's no big advantage on that corner kick. They should just simply say on a corner kick there are no offsides. Now, I guess you have the problem, when do you start offsides back up again? Soccer and offsides, it's really poorly done. I think at a minimum, soccer needs a blue line system like in hockey, where the offsides only kick in at a certain point. And maybe they only kick in, like in hockey, when you have to cross that point correctly. But once you're crossed, forget about offsides. It really takes away from the game and allows teams to stop the attacking team in ridiculous ways. They literally stop them by letting them in. I'm not kidding. The defending team will suddenly move up. They will deliberately step out of the way of the attacking team and let that attacking team flood forward. And as soon as that attacking team passes the ball, it's offside, play is stopped. Ludicrous. It just needs a total revamp. I think a blue line system would solve that one. So, you need a blue line system. You need many more replays. Oh, man. You need fouls to actually count. That's what I was going to say first, before the replays. Old Messi there yesterday. As I was watching him, and I was trying to describe him to somebody who didn't see the game, and I was saying, he was a magician. Flat out. It's like that magician, he's got the card, and he's like, is this your card? And you know it is. And then he puts it back in the middle of the deck, and then bang, it's at the top again. And he's like, oh, there, is that your card? Yeah. And then, oh, as a matter of fact, the card's behind your ear. And he reaches behind your ear, and there's the card. That was Messi. That ball and Messi were, I was saying, it was like having a yo-yo, where no matter what you did, the yo-yo just kept coming back to Messi. The ball just kept coming back. Very, very brilliant play. And then to watch the game afterwards, the Netherlands-Costa Rica game, where there was no great player, there was no brilliance, there was no Messi. What a boring game. I think one of the commentators said something like it was a stalemate or something like that. Was it ever? Oh, it was horrible. Well, Costa Rica is known for their defense and for their offsides, putting the other team offside. They're known for that. It's an actual tactic of a team, putting a team offside. That's like having the little timeouts in basketball where there's too many timeouts as a tactic. The other team's getting on a roll, they get two or three baskets in a row, you call a timeout. You break the momentum. Well, soccer has plenty of that. Soccer also has people pretending they're injured. Another way to break the other team's momentum is you pretend you're injured. It's gotten so bad that they've got a rule where if you are pretending or you're saying that you're hurt, then they're like, you have to get off. Players required to leave the pitch until the next whistle. All very inexact stuff, but anyway, something of an improvement. Well, Neymar, when he got injured, they were like, you know, get this guy off the pitch, and they bring out the hand stretcher, and they literally roll him onto the stretcher and take him away. Well, it turns out he had a fractured vertebrae. And they were rolling him onto the stretcher. And of course, who has the most anguished look on his face 10 times a game? Well, there's two guys. The guy for Netherlands, I think it's Robin, R-O-B-B-E-N. It's interesting that his name is 292, which is, let's just say the 292 has a problem with honesty, more than any other number. So he's got the anguish look on his face constantly. Well, Neymar, the number of times you'll see him in a game with a big anguish look on his face. Now, in fairness, people are attacking Neymar, and they're fouling him, and it's bad. And so Neymar has a little bit to complain about, and then a lot of it is just acting. These stars become actors in soccer, sadly. With the exception of Messi, you want to watch a player who's truly just playing the game. Messi reminds me of Reinhold Messner. Maybe I'll hold that thought, but let me just finish up on soccer, see if I got it all. Oh, I wanted to say Neymar, who got injured. Sadly, he's out. Great player. He goes by Neymar Jr. His dad is Neymar Sr. So that's, you know, basically his name. It's on the back of his uniform. Neymar Jr. J.R. Well, Neymar Jr. is 685, 5 destiny, the accident destiny. Well, he had an accident, all right. And by the way, the 5 has bitter experiences with people. Well, he had a bitter experience with people. Someone broke a bone in his back, in his spine. Amazing, serious, kind of freaky injury, very 5-ish injury. All right, so that was the last couple days in sports. Today, Sunday, is kind of a treat in sports. Yeah, I record on Sunday for a Monday publication date. Today in sports, we have the Tour de France. It's on right now, second day. First few stages, 2 or 3 stages, are in England this year, unusual. You know, the Tour de France moves things around. They keep it fresh. It's roughly a race around the country. That's kind of a good go-to. It's a good sort of basic concept of the race because it sort of indicates how long the race is going to be, roughly. But they are quite liberal in where they actually race. And so this year they're starting, and those first two or three races are in England. And it's kind of fun. You know, I have the English background, and it's a country I can't remember the last time they were in England. It does happen, but not very often. Maybe it was 10 years ago, maybe more. It's going to be a lot of cobblestone stages of the tour this year. There's only one time trial. Sometimes there's two. I'm trying to think if there's sometimes three. The time trials, you know, it's one of those stages that it can be informative sometimes. I think this year, where they put it near the end of the race, it won't be informative. It's hard to get into the Tour de France now, knowing that they're all juicing, knowing that they were all juicing for a very long time. I think Greg LeMond, who won the Tour de France and was a great American cyclist 20 years ago, he sort of called Lance on it and challenged him on it and was ultimately proved right. He was aware of, you know, problems in drugs and cycling 20 years ago. And, you know, cycling is one of these, it's a mega endurance sport. And so drugs can potentially be a massive benefit. And when you read the books by the guys in the sport, I think it was Tyler Hamilton, I think that was the one I got the most out of. And where it was something about honesty, the title of the book, and he just wanted to be honest, and he was. And what was interesting was Tyler Hamilton, when you work out his names, he had a one destiny. Has a one destiny, and the one is the honest quality. And in the end, he wanted to come clean. He wanted to be totally honest, and he did, and he redeemed himself by doing that. You know, Lance Armstrong always took the opposite approach, the approach of, you know, lie with gusto, attack the attackers, deny. Frankly, Lance Armstrong was one of the great cheats in sports history, maybe the greatest, although I'm thinking of a few soccer teams. There's been some cheating soccer teams. Well, you know, soccer is just poorly structured as a sport. Anyway, Tour de France is on in England today, right now. Wimbledon is on. Going to be on in just half an hour, an hour. Breakfast at Wimbledon, they always have in the final day of the tournament. The men's singles. And it's going to be Roger Federer versus Novak Djokovic. Novak Djokovic is one of the top athletes, has been for years, and Roger Federer has been, you know, one of the top dudes for even longer. And Roger Federer has a career record, or yeah, I guess he's had a career that is at the top of tennis. Comparable to Pete Sampras, comparable to the greats of tennis. And I've liked watching Sampras. I didn't care for Sampras when he played. I think part of the problem is with Pete Sampras is there was no emotion. You rarely saw anything from the guy. Whereas someone like Andre Agassi, I could relate to much more. Andre Agassi was the we try harder. Andre embraced Buddhism, and everything about him just sort of appealed to me more. Once he got rid of the crazy hairstyles, and once he stopped trying to appeal to teenage girls, Andre Agassi became a really great tennis player, great ambassador to the game. Sampras never did much, and when he left, he just left the game. Well, what's interesting, Pete Sampras, 3-4-7 total, 7 destiny. In short, Pete Sampras didn't want to be part of the game. He wants his alone time. Well, he's got it. You hardly ever see the guy now. Andre Agassi, he's doing commercials right now in the middle of Wimbledon. You'll see Andre Agassi doing commercials. Andre Agassi, 696, 292, 898 total. Super successful total. And, you know, he's married one of the beautiful tennis women in the sport. Beautiful in terms of her game. She was my favorite female tennis player, I would say. Steffi Graf. And she has, if I'm not mistaken, a 7 destiny. And the thing about a 7-ish person is interesting is they always look just a little bit odd, a little homely, if it's the woman. And Steffi has a bit of a homely aspect to her, and that's that 7. If there was an 8 quality there, if Steffi had an 8 destiny, she would look different, without a doubt. Got a plane flying overhead. So Wimbledon today. Roger Federer against Novak Djokovic. And Federer is a little bit washed up, a little bit, you know, struggling. So is Djokovic lately. And so it's going to be a close one between those two heavyweights. People were predicting Federer. I'm predicting Djokovic in 4 sets, so we'll see. I think, you know, Djokovic's just too young and powerful, and Federer has dominated on Wimbledon on grass. The cool thing with tennis is they have different surfaces. The French Open is on clay, horrible surface, very old-fashioned surface, very slow, totally different game. The Australian Open and the US Open are played on an artificial surface and very fast. But then Wimbledon is played on grass, the fastest surface, and it's the only tournament that's played on grass. It's nice anyway. It kind of reminds me a bit of golf, where you have the different types of courses. In the European courses, they tend to be what are called links courses, closer to the ocean, and just kind of rougher courses, less manicured, less perfect. U.S. courses a little bit more towards the perfect side, but like at this year's U.S. Open, they changed all that. Pinehurst number 2, they restored it to its original, more rustic nature, with massive waste areas and whatnot, and they changed things that way. So it's good to freshen the sport up and give some variety. Now, in a sport like football or soccer or hockey, you don't want that. Hockey, you can avoid it. You groom the ice before each period. Soccer, it's just grass, right? And so you could have rules about the type of grass and the length and everything else and get rid of that as a factor. And by the way, one of the nice things in other years in soccer, the pitch gets just torn up and muddy, and it's a factor. This time around, and probably this is the way it is with soccer now, they have, I know it's true in football, they have artificial and sort of hybrid turfs that are, they have like a plastic reinforcing, and then they have the grass, and the plastic reinforcing supports the grass so that it doesn't get torn up so readily. It's made a big difference in football, and you don't see the mud bowls. And you sure don't see the mud bowls this year in soccer, and that's nice. So, Wimbledon today, as I say, my man Federer, he's kind of like my pets, he's getting old. We got a dog here that's really struggling and showing the signs of discomfort, and this dog has been, well, I guess you could say is my first dog, and been so close to him. And he's a golden retriever, Tank. We call him T-A-N-K-E. Tank is this perfect comfort dog. He knows who needs what. But with me, he always wanted to play. Always. I could not pat him. Just nothing but pat him. He would pull away from that, and he would start turning into play. And in part because Tank always wants to give. He always wants to be giving comfort, giving what the other person needs. He's never wanted to receive. He's always a giving dog. What a wonderful quality. But probably in part because he figured I needed to play. I benefited from play. It puts a smile on my face. So lately, for the first time ever in the last couple of days, he allowed me to comfort him. And the dog came to me and sat around and hung around me and pushed into me and wanted comfort. But then yesterday, he kind of perked up and he wanted me to come outside with him. And we went outside and he wanted to play. And he played several times yesterday. So he got some of his spring back. You know, it just shows he doesn't like being down. Some qualities don't like being down. The three quality in people doesn't like to be down. They want to be up. They want others to be up. What a nice quality. And so no wonder the three is one of those qualities in balance names. The other big sport today, in England as well, because Wimbledon is in England, Tour is in England, is the British Grand Prix, Formula One racing. That's going to be in England later today, as far as I know. I think hasn't happened already, even though they're 8 hours ahead of us. I think it has not happened. In any case, I haven't learned the result. It hasn't been spoiled. And so, with a bit of luck, I'll catch that later on today. Formula One racing is just so primo. I think the only thing I would say is it's a little hard to capture the beauty of it unless you go on board with the onboard cameras, and then you start to get a real beautiful sense of the racing. There should be more on board and less showing the cars at a distance. If you go far enough back from a race car, it doesn't look like it's doing much. When you're on board and bouncing around and seeing how fast those corners come up, you know, it's a different thing altogether. So I look forward to that later today. All right, with soccer, I thought I'd tie it in with my name analysis, and I'd try and find either players that are living the higher side of a name or the not-so-high side of the name, right? There was a game, and I think it was the Brazil game, where Neymar ultimately got injured. I guess this game just about set a record for the number of fouls, number of meaningless whistle blows. If you give somebody a yellow card, that's meaningful, but probably in that game, let's say there was 4 or 5 yellow cards. But there were 54 fouls where they stop play and here you get the ball back kind of thing. Token fouls. What was interesting was you can tell right away when the referee doesn't... The way soccer is currently structured, the referee has to give out a yellow card quickly. They have to. They have to find something that's over the line. Bang, yellow card. As soon as you do that, the teams go, whoa. Because the yellow card's really bad. In a more modern system, you would have a more graduated response, and as soon as something is over the line, you would say you have a 1-minute penalty, and then you have a 2-minute penalty, and then you have a yellow card, and you graduate the response. And people quickly get the exact feel for things, and they play the game legitimately. Wow, this referee was too tolerant, 54 fouls. Neymar gets hurt, out for the entire rest of the tournament. It's interesting, there was a color commentator yesterday, and it was not on the Brazil game. He was doing the Argentina game. He was doing the Netherlands game. And he was commenting on how we all lost out because Neymar got hurt because of the referee. He was exactly right. He was a Spanish color commentator. I've noticed the Spanish ones are good. The two American ones are excellent. And the British ones are, well, really awful. There should never be a British color commentator. I mean, first of all, the British are understated. They don't say much. And then second of all, soccer, not much is going on. You almost don't need a color commentator. You only need a play-by-play guy, just about. And then you get these twits, these thick-skulled ex-soccer players who don't know how to do color commentary, saying, well, you know, it wasn't much in that, was it? Well, what have you said? I find I almost completely disagree with everything they say, whereas this Spanish color commentator guy yesterday was excellent. He constantly is right on top of the game. And it fits, right? It fits with the fact that the South Americans are right on top of the game. They totally get it. And the Americans are trying hard. They're working at it. Anyway, so this referee who blew it in Brazil game, what's his name? Carlos Velasco Carballo. Carlos, 775. Accent looking for a place to happen. The last name, Carballo, 729. Seven's that misunderstood quality. You know, the seven shouldn't be around people, frankly. I mean, you shouldn't have the seven in your name, but if you do, then you don't want to be around people. So this is a ref with two prominent sevens in his name. He shouldn't be around people. When you take just his first name and last name, his combinations are 775, 729, 595, 5 Destiny. Well, did he ever show the 5 Destiny? He refereed a train wreck. And then when you throw in his middle name, which is Velasco, bottom line, his total combination is 821, a 1 Destiny. Well, a 1 is a hard physical number. So, if you have a 1 Destiny, you're going to tolerate a hard physical game. Well, and physical, when we say physical, we mean contact. Soccer is not supposed to be a hard physical contact game. It's supposed to be a minimal physical contact game with people actually playing the soccer ball. So, sure enough, accident looking for a place to happen, did a lousy job of refereeing, and one of the best players in the tournament, to me, he's maybe number 3 best, but he's out because of the referee. Alright, on the good side of things, let's look at someone who had a good combination. They were amazing in a good way. The goalie for the American team, Timothy, that goes by Tim Howard. As Tim Howard, 3 Destiny, 483 total, nothing remarkable, although he does have 2-6 qualities. The 6 is that sort of that competent quality. Certainly he's confident. Well, let's dig a little deeper. He's born Timothy. Timothy Howard. Timothy 652, Howard 786, 8 Destiny, the successful Destiny. And you say, well, what about his middle name? Well, it's Matthew with 2 T's. It turns out it doesn't change the Destiny. No matter how you work it out, this guy has an 8 Destiny. Well, that really fits. This guy's successful. He's a successful goalie in the regular soccer season and in the World Cup. He set a record with the U.S. in their last game. The number of saves that he made was like 15 or 16 or whatever it was. It was a record number of saves. He was just brilliant times. In my notes, I got 16 saves noted. He was brilliant times 16. It wasn't for him that the Americans lost, that's for sure. But then putting it another way, if he had been just an average goaltender, America would have been out even earlier. In that last game against Belgium, the score could have been 5-0. Easy. But hats off to him, and hats off to his good name combinations. You know, really showing the name in action. One other player that has a good name, as it turns out, or, you know, a better than average name, a name that, you know, shows, the player for Argentina, Gonzalo Higuain. It's a hard name to pronounce for a Caucasian like myself. H-I-G-U-A-I-N, Higuain. I guess the H is silent, and the G-U-A-I-N, 3 vowels in a row, is we don't normally run across that particular combination in English. So Mr. Higuain, he scored a beautiful goal for Argentina, thanks to Messi setting it up, of course. But what's his name? Higuain is 426. We've talked about the 426 with the goalie. It might have been for Chile or one of the other South American teams, where the goalie was like the greatest player on that team and just made save after save. Well, that 4-2-6, they work harder than average. They carry more than their share of the load. Well, Higuain almost scored again later in the game. What about his first name? What does it do? First name, Gonzalo, is 459. So he's a 4-2-6 last name, 459 first name. So they're very similar. The 9s can be a specialist and adds power to whatever it's with. Well, it's adding power and specialism to the 4. The 4 is that we've talked about with the muscles. Soccer is a muscle game because you're running 6 or 7 miles a game. That's endurance. You know, it's like Tour de France is a muscle game. Endurance, right? So he's got double dose of that. And then when you add the two names together, you get an 8-7-6-6 destiny. So he has a good destiny, good total, even numbers. Well, he was an even-keeled, solid player for Argentina, without a doubt. And a key part of the win. Had an interesting kind of a freak occurrence. Maybe not freak isn't the right word, but an unusual occurrence. I publish week daily something called Quotes, Thoughts, and Inspiration. I published it for something like 16, 17 years. I've lost track. I have 6,000 subscribers, and I send out quotations, philosophical quotations, thoughtful quotations, interesting, humorous quotations. I send out 9 of them per weekday. Most other people that send them out, they don't send out as many. They don't send them out as frequently. It's not uncommon to send out 1 a week or 3 a week. I send out 45 a week. And they're in 9 categories. And ever since I came up with the categories based on the numbers, the qualities from 1 to 9, it's been a winner. Before that, I was like the rest of them. You know, I'd send out a batch on love or a batch on leadership or whatever. Well, it's not balanced. Doing that is not balanced. Q9 is designed to be consumed daily, especially week daily. It's bite size. It's something that you can digest and think about during your work day. It's a little distraction from your work day that's so small that it actually helps your work day, right? It keeps you focused. It keeps you not being driven insane with boredom or whatever. It keeps you working on a larger picture. And then I have 2 other groups. One of them's called Miss 9. It's like a trivia, miscellaneous 9. 9 miscellaneous items per week. And then I have Amazine. Amazine is meant to be longer stories, more interesting stories. I talked about it once in the Floydcast, but basically once a week I'll send out 3 links to 3 stories, 3 larger stories that, you know, you need to visit the site yourself and read the longer story yourself when you have time. It's worth it kind of thing. Well, all of them are groups on Yahoo Groups. To go to yahoogroups.com, Yahoo bought eGroups 15 years ago, and they changed the name to Yahoo Groups, and these groups are, they allow you to have a mailing list. It's managed by Yahoo, and the problem these days, and actually has been worse in the past, and you know, the internet, there are many ways to bring something down, and spam is one of the things that brings down email. So the way they've coped with that is they've sort of tightened up all the rules to do with emailing. Nowadays, most of us use web-based email. So most of us have a Gmail account or a Yahoo account or sometimes a Hotmail account. And those are the big ones. You might have an account at your service provider, for example, like at Comcast. But there's been some steps to make there be less spam. And, you know, the interesting thing is I have my email all over the internet. Like on my website, I have it just freely exposed. It's not obfuscated, as they say. It's not assembled out of JavaScript code so that you can't figure out what it is unless you're a human type thing. It's just right there in the free, clear text. And yet I don't get much spam. I get extremely small amounts. It's because people filter it out. The systems are in place to filter it out. They assign scores to emails and all this stuff. So I get it. Spam is bad, and there's all these anti-spam measures. So one of the anti-spam measures is, even though I have my own domain, justthinkit.com, I can't send an email from justthinkit.com. I mean, I probably could if I paid more and my internet service provider for my website would then be my host service, but it might not work out anyway because of the scores that are assigned to emails and everything else. And so what I end up doing is I email from Yahoo. Came back to my groups. The groups I used to publish by going to the group page. For example, my Q9 publication, I would go to the Q9 group page on Yahoo Groups, and then I would click on the submit, and then I would put my Q9 text in there, and then I'd put a subject line on it and send it out. Well, they took away that web interface just recently, you know, 6 months ago or so. I don't know why, probably an anti-spam measure, they're constantly doing that. Well, now the only way that's left is I have to email it from my approved email account. I have given myself permission, obviously, and no one else to email the group. It's still problematic. For example, you can still spam my address. So you can fake that you're me in a spamming program, and then you could send to the group, and it would be allowed. And it has happened, I think, maybe twice in 15 years, which, considering I publish 200 times a year, it's not a big deal. Out of roughly 3,000 times I've published, maybe it's 4,000. I've only been faked, and spam has been sent on my behalf only two or three times. Anyway, Yahoo Mail has been changing their interface the last few years, making it worse, making it noticeably worse. People on Slashdot talking about it, just like in disgust. People on Slashdot hate Yahoo Mail. Everyone, you know, prefers Gmail, Google Mail. Well, the thing is, I checked it out yesterday or the day before, and Gmail is big. It's about 400 million people use Gmail. But 250 million use Yahoo Mail. You know, Yahoo hasn't gone away despite the current contempt, well-earned contempt, that we're all techies are showing to Yahoo Mail these days. It's still a big player. Anyway, these, quote, upgrade quotes of Yahoo Mail have been so bad that me and those I support, we've avoided going to them. We're like, oh, you can pry my old Yahoo interface from my cold dead hands kind of thing. And then they changed it again a few months back, and I was like, well, I'm going to skip that one too. And, you know, I've been sort of hanging around at the trailing edge of the market rather than at the leading edge. Well, when I send, it comes up with a dialogue and it says, you know, message sent successfully. And you click a button and you go back to your inbox. Well, for this past week, when I successfully sent a message, Yahoo did not send the message. And not only that, it didn't even keep a copy in my sent folder. Those bits and bytes of that email literally went to the great bit bucket in the sky. They literally vaporized and disappeared off the end of the earth. No one got a copy of those emails for a week. Luckily, I discovered it on Friday. I was kind of, you know, it's a little bit of an upsetting. It's a big deal. It's ridiculous. And you have to, like, I have to tell 6,000 people without boring them to death, but at least giving them the full picture. So I slept on it. And Saturday morning yesterday, I composed a big long preamble to explain. And then I republished all those things that didn't get sent out. So I had a Q9 hiccup last week, and it affected my Miss 9 and my Amazing, but I only published them once a week, and Q9 I published 5 times a week. It's not a good feeling to publish 5 times a week to 6,000 people. That's 30,000 emails I thought I sent that I didn't send. That's not a good feeling. Well, what else did I want to talk about today? There's a number of good things going on. Sort of ration myself or choose the best or choose something I haven't talked about for a while. Had a fire in the fire pit yesterday. Had a couple recently. I've been having a sort of a project because I'm sort of laid up a little bit and have a little bit more free time than normal. I've been trying to find ways to get something done and yet not have to physically do too much. So what I've been doing a couple times is I've had a fire in the backyard and then I read. And I've been burning some of the... I have too much wood. It's a problem that you don't run into too often. I just scavenge wood in the neighborhood, bring it home on my bike or skateboard, or sometimes there's enough of it to bring it home in the pickup truck. And I have too much. I have stacks and stacks of it. And I just realized, hey, it's cramping my style a little bit, so I just sort of pushed back the envelope a little bit. Just going to burn through it this year. This is going to be a burning year. And deliberately not accumulate more wood. Even though I could, there's construction in the neighborhood, and it's just sitting there. It's just, you know, they have their refuse waste wood piles, and you can just pick it up. One of the nice things is we, in our fires of late, is we've been burning good wood. And boy, is it a treat. You know, I'm the type to burn just about anything, and instead of having to fill up a green recycling container, if you have branches like that have fallen down, we've got some really big trees, and sometimes they drop branches, and burn those branches, right? Well, when that wood drops, it drops because it's a little bit rotten, or quite rotten. It's rotten means it has less strength. Well, it has less strength because it has less glue, which means it has less, you know, fuel factor, so it doesn't burn as well. Or it's wet, or it's green, which is to say wet. Well, when you take lumber, cut, finished wood, and you take new wood, which I've got all kinds of little ends and shorts and whatnot, And when you burn just that, it just burns so beautifully. And the bigger, this is sort of a little thing I've discovered with fires, which didn't figure out before. The larger the piece of wood, the more fragrant it is when it burns. And you're like, what? How can it make any difference at all? Well, what it is when you say you have a pencil-thin piece of wood and you put it on the fire, it bursts into flames, and then it quickly burns out and it's gone. And you get this repeatedly. You get flames and gone, flames and gone. Well, when you have a big piece of wood, it can't all burn at once. Especially when you have a big, long, large piece of wood and large in all dimensions. It smokes. And it's heating up. And so you have interior of the wood is heating up and turning into gas. And then the gas is coming out. Some of the gas is burning. That's your flames. And then some of it is just drifting around. And those are the aromatic compounds. Aromatic is an actual chemical concept. There are aromatic hydrocarbons, a family, a type of hydrocarbon. The compounds are the lighter compounds. Aromatics, I'm thinking like in an oil refinery. The higher ends, my dad used to call them the high ends. You have crude oil coming in and you get different products from the crude oil. Crude oil is a mix of oils. Crude oil is very impure on every level. You know, you think of it as you get oil coming out of the ground and it goes straight into your gas tank. Nothing could be further from the truth. So you separate it out into very thick, low-end stuff like waxes and greases. The middle stuff is like gasoline and stove oil. And then the high ends can be even just pure vapors. They never condense unless you put them under pressure, like propane, butane, that kind of thing. So when you heat up that log, the high ends come off. They turn to vapor. Well, on that big piece of wood, and it's sort of gently smoking there, and that's where you get the nicest smells. You've got that wood that's been curing for 80 years. It's like a fine wine. And it's been drying out, and you get rid of water. And so when you get a vapor, there's virtually no water in it. And this wood has all been carefully, I've stored it, and you know it's carefully dried and everything, and it's almost perfectly dry. And so you're just getting the wood vapors, the wood smells. And it smells wonderful. We've really enjoyed that. The other thing I've enjoyed is just going to my various storage areas and choosing what I'm going to burn, that I'm choosing it from the perspective of freeing up space, getting rid of problems like some of the wood I scrap wood that I recover has nails in it. I always try and burn the wood with nails in it so that I don't have wood with nails in it hanging around to scratch people. And shorts don't stack well, and so burning all the shorts. I had some outside piles, I have a number of them, and sub piles, and we have large trees and they shed things and drop things and leaves and various things, and when you have piles and leaves, the leaves get into the piles and then it becomes home for critters, and plus it makes the wood in the piles rot more readily and not dry out as well. So I've been going around and getting rid of the leaves, getting rid of the smaller sub piles, temporary piles that became semi-permanent, getting rid of some of the dead branches around the place, cleaning. And it's just very satisfying, and a fire lends itself to all that, because you got the fire going, you go over to a little sub-pile, and you're like, hey, I can burn this, and I can store that, and get this for burning for tomorrow's fire type thing, and then the next thing you know, that little area is cleaned up, and then the next day you're like, well, I could clean it up a little bit better, and you go back, and you get rid of the leaves and the branches, and then bang, the place looks nicer. And we've done so many things to our backyard. It was, you know, let's say a typical... how to describe it? A typical American backyard of a not overly fussily maintained property. We don't spend a lot of time on the outsides. You know, we're not trying for a rating and photos in a magazine. I'm avoiding the word redneck, but there were some redneck properties to the property, and they're gradually going away. We're raising the tone of the property. It feels good. The backyard especially, we've done so many different things that I'll talk about one day. And then, of course, you get a little bit of food when you have a backyard fire. We built the fire pit, and so it's all very safe, and there's like concrete on all sides, and then there's sand around that, and anything burnable is literally 10 feet away. Nice, safe structure. And then, you know, sometimes we'll have shrimp on the barbie. Last night, I realized I hadn't had it for a while. I treated myself. I had a toasted peanut butter sandwich. You just take bread, throw it on the grill on top of the fire, and lightly toast it, and then slobber some peanut butter on it. And man, does that taste good. It's a whole meal. And it's almost perfect in its nutrients. It's missing a little bit of vitamin C. That's about it. It's got B vitamins in the bread. It's got healthy oils in the peanut butter. It's got protein in the bread, protein in the peanut butter. It's got really everything. You can just about live on it. Throw in some romaine lettuce in there and you've got a complete meal. Well, I'd eaten my romaine lettuce earlier. I ate a whole head of romaine lettuce each day, just about on average. That gets me my greens. The other thing I did in the backyard was, I hadn't done it for a while, is I took out my acoustimeter, my very nice meter for measuring microwave radiation. And I try and force myself to periodically re-measure around the place. It's like a security measure. Wireless radiation is increasing all the time. By its nature, you can't dose people equally. You cannot do it. And so it's up to each individual to measure, you know, their own dose, their own poison. As they add new spectrum, new frequencies, new Gs, you know, as 3G becomes 4G, becomes 5G, they're working on it, LTE and super LTE and all those various things. The energies go up, the radiation goes up. And in the back here, we have various structures, and I wanted to see how are the structures absorbing the microwave energy. And so I measured in quite a few places, probably took, you know, 50 to 100 different readings, and you can really see the variation. It's about a factor of 10. You can be sitting there, and you just move that meter within your headspace, within your sitting space. Say, move it in a circle, a 1 foot radius circle all around your head, and you'll get readings that vary by at least a factor of 5 to a factor of 10. In our case, all the readings are too high. They're 100 times too high in our backyard at the fire pit. 100 times. That's depressing. Luckily, we're not out there all the time. For people who don't know about it, people with children living with microwave radiation, it's very sad. They are being attacked. One of the guys in one of the resonance, the documentary Resonance Beings of Frequency, he said that the type of cancer that he got from microwaves, he went to the doctor and he was sure he was getting it. He was getting, you know, bad symptoms, and the doctor was like, no, no, no. And then finally, years later, the doctor said, you've got cancer. And he said, you know, how long does that cancer take? He said, 8 years. And it had been exactly 8 years since he started getting the symptoms, and since they started introducing the microwaves into his life, into his world, and, you know, put the tower up near his house type thing. Well, our dog, who is really struggling and aging rapidly, he's been in this home, this microwave environment, for 8 years. Just about exactly. Right on schedule. And there he is. I don't have any doubt that he's got cancer. Yeah, he's probably got some hip issues, whatever, but it doesn't show like hip issues. With hip issues, you see the creature limping and not wanting to move. Well, Tank likes to move, and he'll use any excuse to move. But just to see him running down in energy and to need comfort and to be in pain and showing the symptoms of pain and all that is sad. And it's especially sad to know that because of living in this environment, he's going to die early of a cancer caused by microwaves. So that was, you know, a little bit of a down, a little bit of the sobering part of our fire in the fire pit yesterday. I think I'm going to get to the of the weeks, maybe a little bit earlier than usual. Just before I do that, there's been about 15 different microwave radiation, wireless, Wi-Fi, smart appliance stories since I did the last update. So in about 3 weeks, 15 stories. It's about one story a day. This is happening so very rapidly and so very much changing the landscape in ways that none of us, and my definition of none is, if 99 people out of 100 are not aware of it, then nobody's aware of it. It's a steamroller. Anyway, we'll move on. Bad driver of the week. I don't have any particular stories, bad drivers. I have a few that I've sort of saved, put in the notes, but they're not too critical. One amazing thing happened this last week in the driving world. And it happened, of all places, in British Columbia, where I was born, where I'm from. The headline, or the first part of the story, said, drivers in British Columbia will see speed limits on many rural highways increased to what is commonly referred to as the 85th percentile. Well, I'm telling you, you don't see a headline like that very often. That's an intelligent headline. 85th percentile? a speed based on something statistical and not just the whim of which community wants to make money from speeding tickets, which community is thinking of the children and obsessively worried about speed to the point of punishing the drivers, which community doesn't care about speed and just goes with whatever everyone else is doing. This is calculated, dynamically changing speeds. Depending on conditions and based on what 85% of the drivers are doing. Oh, this is wonderful. This is an amazing story. I'll definitely have this link up eventually. And then it says there will also be a new set of laws to enforce the practice of keep right except to pass on multi-lane highways. Well, I definitely talked about that maybe 5 or 6 podcasts ago, having gone up to Washington State for a little trip, and one of the more obvious problems was to see all the people in the left lane. Not a lot of them, but when they're there and they're driving the same speed as in the right lane, it drives you nuts. Absolutely nuts. And it's not a big problem in the U.S., but in Canada, and especially in British Columbia, this is a massive problem. In part because one of the largest minorities in British Columbia, from Asia, culturally, many of them have never grown up with cars. The older generations, they grew up with rickshaws, and they grew up with walking around, and they grew up with living on the water. They don't know how to drive. And they're inherently cautious. The same culture is inherently cautious. They drive stereotypical vehicles. You can just name the brands, Volvo, BMW, Mercedes. Those are the brands they drive. And they are poor drivers because they are overly cautious. Now, you could say that's a good reason to be a poor driver, but it's still a poor driver. So they're the types, when they're in the left lane, they go the same speed as the right lane. That's what you do when you don't know how to do something. You just follow the person next to you. Well, that's fatal in driving. It's very bad. And it creates road rage and it creates problems. Well, now in British Columbia, new laws to enforce the practice of keep right except to pass. I'm really actually genuinely amazed that I talked about this just a few months back and bang, it's coming into practice. I'm amazed by that, flat out. So in this one story, one place, two amazing things have happened. Then I got a quote here. Changes to the Motor Vehicle Act give police more power to enforce the requirement that slower vehicles keep right, and added signage and marking to increase compliance. And that's what you need. You need signs to remind people, hey, if you don't get right, it's going to be a big penalty. My notes I wrote down, this is almost too good to be true. I also wanted to point out that British Columbia has had the worst speed limits and the worst drivers that I know of anywhere. And it's been like this for decades, tens of years. For some reason, in British Columbia, the speed limits have always been too low. And, you know, you really notice it in British Columbia because when you come down to the States, which is right next door, bang. Although, admittedly, Washington State, the speed limits are a bit, there have been, you know, plenty of years where the speed limits there have been illogical and limiting. The interstate here is typically 2 lanes, and you know, when you have 2 lanes and you have too low of a speed limit, it's easy for it to get all bottled up, and it's, you know, kind of depressing. Whereas when you go down to Arizona, for example, 75 miles an hour, and, you know, they just seem to have a bigger budget for their highways, and they get the job done. But in Arizona, and I've seen it, you get accidents at 75 miles an hour, and suddenly you're watching NASCAR, and they're dangerous, and plenty of people die. Arizona is really still something somewhat like the Old West. In Phoenix, Arizona, they shoot guns regularly into the air, and the bullets come down. That's the weird thing about a bullet. You fire it up, and it will come down, thanks to gravity. And when it comes down, it's going at 100 miles an hour. No, it's not going at 500 or 600 miles an hour like when you first shot it, but it's going probably more than 100. A human will go terminal velocity 100, but a bullet is probably going closer to 200 because it's smaller, more aerodynamic. And so people die regularly in Phoenix from... It's not funny. But it's so predictable, and it's so ridiculous that people would fire guns into the air. It's like the Darwin Awards. They have the Darwin Awards for people that did something so ridiculous and stupid, and then they died from it. That's what it takes to win a Darwin Award. You have to have done something really stupid and then died from it. Well, at least in Phoenix, you know, once or twice a year, someone earns a Darwin Award. So British Columbia has had these just ridiculous low speed limits. I worked at the University of British Columbia for a while. I studied there. They redid the highways going out to the university. It's a massive land deal. the peninsula that the university's on, the endowment lands as they're called, it's a serious amount of land. I wouldn't mind betting that 10 or 20 years from now, the University of British Columbia will be 100,000 students. When I was there, it was 50. It's a biggie. It's similar in size to the University of Washington, which is a tiny bit bigger, or was at the time. So they redid the highway. So they have these highways going through endowment lands, going to the university itself, which is right on the tip of the peninsula. Well, when they redid the highways, what were the speed limits? Well, let's see. On one of them, the speed limit was 35. Temporarily, briefly, getting up to 42 before going back to 35. And then on the other highway, which is like divided and multiple lanes and like nothing and nobody for 3/4 of a mile or a mile or whatever it is, 50. You could go 50 on there. We have a road 3 blocks away where I can go 50. It's just it's not even a highway. Technically, they've given it a highway name, but it's basically just a fast road. Where I live, there's plenty of fast roads. And they vary the speeds. Each piece of road has a speed chosen for it. And honestly, where I live right now, there are very few places where I would change the speed limit of the road. It's almost perfect everywhere. The only thing you got to watch out for is the speed does change from one area to another. Usually not a lot. And if you don't know the area, you can find yourself going the speed you were going a mile ago, and now you're speeding. And it can happen occasionally. Usually you get a clue. I mean, if you come into a more congested area, usually the speed will drop accordingly by a little bit. Anyway, British Columbia, the highways, maddening. I could just go on and on with stories. There's like a major highway in Marine Drive. It's just a road, but it's become a major highway, 3 and 4 lanes now. Artery feeding into the city. 30 miles an hour. You get to go 30 miles an hour on that 4-lane highway. I'm not kidding. 30 miles an hour. By the way, the speed limit everywhere in the city is 30 miles an hour. You can take a nothing back road and the speed limit is 30. So this highway, well, you get the same speed as a nothing back road. Wow. Only in British Columbia. Well, finally, after, let's say, 30 or 40 years, finally it's going to change. So that's the good drivers of the week being rewarded in British Columbia. Who would have thought? I was torn between a couple of re-watches of the week, which one to talk about. I think I'm going to talk about the shorter one, as I think it might be. It's got a shorter name, Elf. The movie Elf. I think it came out in 2005. Let me just look that up and make sure. All right, Elf came out in 2003. So it's an 11-year-old movie. A kid's movie, right? Will Ferrell, who generally has not gotten many props as being a good actor, and some sort of average supporting cast, Mary Steenburgen, and Zoe Deschanel, forgot about that, and then of course Ed Asner, Bob Newhart, James Caan, a nice supporting cast around Will Ferrell, who clearly dominates and is so wonderful in this movie. Directed by Jon Favreau, who there's a part of him I really don't like. I haven't exactly put my finger on it, but I'm just working out in my head. Jon Favreau has a 7.75 total. Wow. That's amazing. What are the odds of that? So here we are talking about a kid's movie. How often do I do that? Well, I think this is the first time. Will Ferrell was so fantastic in this movie. The movie is well written, well conceived. Everyone does their part. It's well directed, but it's Will Ferrell the kid, and what a great kid. What I'd like to say about Elf and the rewatchability, this 11-year-old movie, I mean, that's just so off the end of the earth. They're hyping movies every week. Who had the great opening of the week? The movie industry, they just keep shoveling that garbage. It's just like shoveling manure. And once in a while, despite their very best efforts, there's a diamond in that manure. And someone reaches in and grabs it and pulls it out and they wash it. And it becomes a diamond, and just a diamond. And it rises so very far above the manure. Hang on, I just caught a moth. I gotta put it out. We try and run with the doors open here and get fresh air. That's the way to cool the place even in the summertime. And as a result, you get very large moths here. I mean, we get some small ones too, but mostly the large ones, and we're talking more than an inch long. You grab them and you feel like you have like a little bird in your hand there. And then I just toss them out the back door. They fly away, hopefully. I know with a moth, they're so delicate, and the wings are so delicate that they probably struggle a bit after being caught like that, but hopefully they survive and thrive. Certainly mean them no harm. But Elf, it truly is a giant of a movie. It is, I think, the greatest kids' movie ever. One of the best, one of the greatest, if not the greatest Christmas movies ever. Because it captures the child mind. And it makes it funny and poignant. And there's just something so timeless about the naivety of a child, the perspective of a child. You know, I'm just racking my brain at the moment trying to think of another movie that so wonderfully captures the essence of a child. The movie Jack with Robin Williams comes close. But, you know, honestly, if you hold the two up, it's so distant. It's so much inferior to Elf. Hats off to everybody associated with the movie Elf. It's one that got away. It's one of the movies that was meant to be a 6 out of 10, but it became a 9. And they kind of hate it, you know, because they want you to go on to that next movie and the one after and the one after. You know, year after year, Elf is shown at Christmas time. It's not uncommon around Christmas time to see, and I've seen it more than once, one of the channels will decide that day to show nothing but Elf all day for 24 hours, back to back to back, nothing but the movie Elf. They know something that the movie industry doesn't want us to know. They know that we will rewatch it and rewatch it and rewatch it. When you discover a good type of coffee, do you just drink it once and go, well, that was nice, now I'm on to the next one? Not many of us do that. There are some. There are some that vary their food, that vary their drink. They like variety. But you know, for most of us, many of the things in our lives, many of our comforts, we go back to them again and again. Weirdly, we don't do it with movies. It's really weird. It just shows their dominance over us in the movie industry. They determine what we think we want to watch. And it's all garbage all the time, with occasionally a mistake. Elf was a grand mistake. It's a thing of beauty and a joy forever, and a wonder to behold, and boy do they regret it. So that's my rewatch of the week. Yet another viewing of Elf. I've probably seen it 50 times, I don't know. If I counted bits, I'm sure I've seen it 100 times. I hope I watch it 100 more. You know, some weeks I've had a cool thing of the week, and I realized that I could have an uncool thing of the week. The two halves of the coin, right? Trying for that balance in all things. I'm just trying to decide which one to do first. So going through, I got a couple in each category. Here's a cool thing of the week. This is sort of contemporary. It was in baseball. Blue Jays baseball. Blue Jays this year, for some reason, are doing a little better than average. Canadian baseball team in the Major League Baseball, which is mostly American teams. In fact, frankly, other than Blue Jays, they're all American teams. Anyway, the Blue Jay team was up. They were batting, and they had the bases loaded. Batter hit the ball. The runner at second was tagged. But at the time, it was ruled that they had missed the tag on this runner. So the play by the fielding team went to the plate where they tried to get someone out at the plate. And they did a force out at the plate. By, you know, you throw the ball to the catcher, he tags home plate, and bang, you got a guy out. Baseball recently introduced the challenge system. I remember I talked about how they're gradually updating their rules, unlike soccer. And they can now challenge a plate. The Blue Jays now challenge the play, saying that their runner, their own runner, was tagged out at second. So, just have to picture this, how creative they were in their minds. The manager goes, okay, they say our runner was not tagged out at second. I want them to review it because I think our runner was tagged out. Now, why did they want that? Well, if the runner was tagged out at second, then there wouldn't be a force at home. Sure enough, they did the challenge, they did the review, the runner was tagged out at second, there wasn't a force at home, and so the run scored. Wasn't that brilliant? That was brilliant and delightful and cool. Someone was thinking, someone took their thinking pill that day. Okay, uncool thing. This happened last week or a little bit before. I go to a deal site. There are daily deals, and there are, like, you know, they call them editor's choice there. So, like, you know, above average deals, all categories. It's really great. It beats couponing, by the way. There are online coupon sites, but they're very problematic. This site does all the work for me. I guess it's in the category of things that I really love, like Costco and Pete's Coffee and Subway sandwiches, my GMC truck. This site is called dealnews.com. Deal, D-E-A-L, news, N-E-W-S.com. It's worth going there daily, especially to check out their editor's choice page. So, I went to Deal News, and they said there was a special on memory, a type of computer memory. There are many different kinds, and, you know, the average person doesn't fully really understand all of them, but this was in the category of chips, or what you'd call a thumb drive, or that kind of memory. SDHC, or a memory card technology, of which there are several. Well, this one, I think it was a thumb drive. It was a 128 gig thumb drive, so it's the largest capacity thumb drive pretty much you can get these days. A staggering amount of storage, by the way, in a device the size of your thumb. And the special was $40. This was the best price I've seen. It was noteworthy, and I think I might have gone there, or for some reason I was sort of checking it out. I wasn't going to actually buy it, but I just sort of go through the motions sometimes, and it's partly just to sort of cement it into my memory and track the prices and track when does it make sense to up your storage to the next level or whatever. Just, you know, something I do as a computer guy. So I went to Tiger Direct, and I might have typed in, instead of bringing the link over, I typed it in. It's a long story, but it's the way my computer's set up. It's sometimes easier to type it in. So I typed in memory, or I clicked on their own links. So the deal was $40 for 128 gigs. So that's roughly about 33 cents a gig, a third of a dollar a gig, okay? And I think I actually typed in the brand, like the name. Let's say the name was ABC Memory, and let's say it had a subname. ABC Go Memory, let's say that was the name of it. And I typed in ABC Go into Tiger Direct. That's where the special was, tigerdirect.com. And they came up with a slightly different one. They came up with an 8 gig, which is 16 times smaller, okay? So mine was $40 for one that was 16 times bigger. So if it's 16 times smaller and my special was $40, the price should be like $3, right? Brace yourself. The price was $112.81 for a memory device that was 16 times smaller. This is so far beyond acceptable. It shows that these online sites, they are really preying on people who don't know the value of things, especially volatile things like memory. Sadly, Amazon does this. If you go to Amazon, you type in any product you care to name, let's say toothpaste, you know, you have a particular brand, you type it in, and you'll get not one, but 2, 3, 5, depending on the product, 10, 20 links, 1,000 links I've seen for that same product. Well, when you scroll through them, they're not all the same price. Not at all. Sometimes there are reasonable differences. Sometimes you'll see one of the links will be a lower price, but when you click on it, then they add shipping. And then the other one is a slightly higher price, but shipping is free when you buy more than $35, as Amazon is structured. And that's totally legitimate and fine. But it's very common on Amazon that you'll get 4 or 5 links, and they are 4 or 5 prices, period. They're just 4 or 5 different prices. Well, which one do you click on? How do you know you're getting the same product in all cases? Why do they have 5 of them? It's insidious. It's nasty. And it's them preying on what people don't notice. People just, you know, say, this is what I want. It comes up, they click it, they buy it. In fact, Amazon patented or tried to patent one-click technology where you literally click once and the entire purchase happens. Talk about impulse buying. So you have those suspect prices, those corrupt prices, those sleazy prices, and then you have one-click purchasing? Ooh, yeah. Profit from ripoff, that's what that is. Well, this one took it to the next level. Tiger Direct is, I'll let you make up your own mind about them, but they're on the fringe they're on the fringe of computer pricing. I've gotten some good deals there. You have to be very careful, I would say that. And here we are. The same name, the same product, hey, just get me my Toms of Maine toothpaste, please. And coming up with the link, I worked it out. The original sale price per gigabyte was 31.25 cents. When I went to Tiger Direct and typed in the same information, the deal they came up with was $14.10 per gigabyte versus 31 cents. A factor of 50 more expensive. That's 5,000%. A 5,000% ripoff. You could buy 50 times as much storage. And by the way, the one that was on sale on Deal News, it's way more valuable. The more dense the memory is, the more valuable it is. In other words, it doesn't scale. In fact, what happens is as the newer thumb drives come out with more capacity, the old ones become worthless, and they stop selling them altogether. They don't want the bottom to come completely out of the market. You could sell, like this ripoff price was on an 8 gig, you could sell a 4 gig, a 2 gig, a 1 gig, a 256 meg, and they used to. I remember buying a 32 meg thumb drive chip, and wow, I was like, you know, that was worth getting. 32 meg, and now we're up to more than 32 gig. 4,000 times increase in capacity. 4,000,000% increase. So the point is that the old ones drop off the table, they're worthless. Well, here is this worthless one. By the way, the real value of that 8 gig stick that Tiger Direct was selling for $112, the real value of that is about $4. I saw a deal this last week that was $4 or $5. And they're selling it for $112. So that's my uncool thing of the week. Be careful when you're buying stuff. Know the value of stuff, especially things like memory. They're so easy to buy. Just be careful. All right, I'm going to finish up with the quote of the week. Got a number of different quotes here, a number of different ones. It's always a little bit hard to choose because it's a wealth of riches. I love quotes, and there's lots of good ones that are really worth thinking about. I'll just go with the top one in the file. It says, if you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. This is by Nikola Tesla. You know, Nikola Tesla was far, far ahead of his time, to the point where he was sort of considered by the government a threat. And what's really going on there? What's really going on there is he's a threat to the commercial interests. They don't want things to happen too fast. In case you think that we live in bountiful times and highly innovative times, no. We live in evolving times where they benefit every step along the way. And the GEs, Westinghouse, GE, you know, their famous battle, especially GE, they don't want too much innovation. In wireless, they don't want too much innovation, just enough. Just keep bumping it up one step and one step. But they don't want suddenly people to realize, hey, wireless is basically poison, and suddenly we evolve something better, or we lower the doses much, much more in a more intelligent way. They don't want that. They'll go a few decades. They'll kill off a few billion before they come around to enlightened wireless, we'll call it. Anyway, if you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. The founder of the Cavalier philosophy, Mr. Alfred J. Parker, who passed away in the early 60s, so what would that be, 50 years ago? He said, all of life is vibration. It was one of the principles, one of the points they taught. And it's one of these things where you hear it, and you kind of go, yeah, okay. And you don't really have a reason to doubt it, but you don't really have a reason to get it. Well, how interesting that I came up with spring and loop theory, which absolutely says that energy, frequency, and vibration are absolutely at the core of spring and loop theory. They are spring and loop theory. The springs are vibrating. They are the energy component. Of course, they vibrate at a frequency, right? And the loops moderate it. It's like putting your thumb on the frets of the guitar and you moderate the frequency. It's exactly like that. So Mr. Tesla was absolutely right to find the secrets of the universe. I really do hope to expand my theory more, and I have, you know, more realizations and more to write about. It is profound. It won't surprise me if it takes 50 to 100 years to fully embrace what I've come up with in my theory. And yeah, there'll be argument about who came up with what. People will claim little bits, and they'll say, well, you just put together A and B and C and D. And well, I know today, 2014, that there are parts of my theory that no one else has come up with, that no one else has put it all together. And for me, it's now just a process of trying to verbalize it and maybe simulate it. The cool thing about a simulation is, you know, it's nothing quite like visuals to show somebody how something works. explaining it, talking about it is good, but it can be like a lecture, right? It's like I came out with my authoritative research tome called Toxic. It hasn't got a lot of views. I don't know how many reads it's got. I haven't looked through my stats recently, but, you know, it's probably getting looked at. But at least my fluoride videos are more popular than ever. Over 500 views each. It's a steady growth curve, as it should be. The fluoride thing is horrific. But Toxic does a great job of sort of putting it all in perspective and comparing things. Like, one of the things I got from my Toxic research was how bad caffeine is, was, and is, and how it's cumulative and how it's in so many foods. And the latest Costco flyer came out and shows, you know, it's, here's what it says on the front. More than $1,100 in savings inside. And they're basically like coupons or discounts that they're telling you about for the next period of time, for about a month, next month. Well, one of the things they're advertising on there is energy shots. Costco, or Kirkland brand, energy shots. And that's too bad. Those energy shots, they have much more caffeine than normal. And it can be a killer, because what happens is people take the energy shots more readily. More of them, and in some cases they even use them as drink mix, right? You put in a shot of hard liquor of some kind, and you throw in an energy shot to flavor it. Caffeine, watch out. Try and keep it down to that one cup a day in the morning. That's what I do. So, if you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. As Mr. Parker said over and over again, all of life is vibration. It's so real and so true. And it's so interesting to watch how they don't want us to know that. They don't want solutions. They don't want an explanation of how life works. Because first of all, it'll make religion look even more ridiculous. And so as a result, we get the opposite of an explanation of how life works. We get the Big Bang. Oh yeah, in the beginning there was a Big Bang. Oh, thank goodness. Garbage. Garbage in, garbage out. They want us to be garbage. Absolutely. They feed us garbage. They teach us garbage. They lie to us constantly. They want us to become garbage so that they can walk on us. Absolutely. Because, well, why do they do that? Let you figure that out. So, quote of the week, thanks to Mr. Tesla. Well, I realized while I was watching the tour and it was coming up to the end of today's stage, I realized, hey, wait a minute, the Wimbledon tennis is on. And I turned to the tennis just in time to see Roger Federer win the first set. Now, I picked Djokovic, even though some of the experts were picking Federer. I picked Djokovic because he's younger and he has good endurance. And Federer is just, he's showing his age a little bit of late. I'm genuinely surprised that Federer won, even though the point is that the reason they picked Federer is that Federer keeps winning on grass. For some reason, Federer's game is just really well suited to grass, and he's won like 6 out of the last 7 times or something like that. He's got some fantastic winning record on grass. His number of Wimbledon Grand Slam tournaments that he's won is really high. So, we've got ourselves a barn burner here. I'm looking forward to it. This has been Floyd Maxwell, JustThinkIt.com, doing a Floydcast, number 21 for July the 7th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.